Now more than ever, Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of our podcast this week is Samuel Logan, founder and CEO of Evidencity.
If we hadn't have made the decision around the data schema that we made, we would today not be in the position that we're in to leverage the AI technology that's in the market that, frankly, we need to leverage to keep up with the pace at which things are moving right now.
This is Samuel. After bootstrapping Evidencity as his fourth venture, Samuel has spent a decade building a company with a profound mission: creating transparency to eliminate modern slavery in global supply chain. His journey began by addressing a critical gap in the market, helping multinational corporations access reliable data about their suppliers in regions where information was not available online. And what started as a network of people physically retrieving documents in over 80 countries evolved into a sophisticated data platform that now helps uncover hidden networks facilitating forced labor. Samuel's commitment to transparency goes beyond simple compliance, focusing on the 30% of companies truly willing to lift the rocks and see what's underneath their supply chains. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Samuel to my podcast. We explore the counterintuitive decisions that transform good companies into remarkable ones. His approach challenges the move fast and break things mentality that dominates the startup world. Samuel reveals why the hardest business choices often aren't about what to do, but about what to stop doing, especially when everybody around you expects the opposite. We discuss why sometimes you need to step back and work under the hood of your business rather than racing forward, and how what seems like an obvious path in the market can often be a mirage. Throughout our conversation, Samuel shares the moments when slowing down actually accelerated his success, and why rebuilding foundations allowed him to capitalize on opportunities his competitors couldn't see. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, how to recognize when your business needs to take two steps back to ultimately move 10 steps forward. Secondly, why your first hires post-funding should focus on leverage points rather than immediate revenue generation. Thirdly, how implementing user manuals for leadership creates vulnerability and clarity that transforms team dynamics. And lastly, how to structure pipeline confidence weighting systems that prevent optimism bias in your forecasting. Well, hi, Samuel. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on my podcast.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I got introduced to you, and of course, then I always do my research. And then I looked at your LinkedIn profile, and that was intriguing to me. And I saw that you've been building the business since for a good 10 years now. I was intrigued with the name of the company, Evidencity, and I got even more intrigued with what's on your website. So I had to ask to come over. But before we start talking about the company and to give too much intrigue here, a little bit about you. What's driving you? What do you get energy from as an entrepreneur?
You know, one of the things that I get energy from is the people I work with, seeing them grow as young professionals. I'm not the oldest person in the company, but I'm one of the oldest people. And we work with a lot of folks from all over the world. And so there's the first thing is once someone joins our core team, because we have this sort of talent pool process that people sort of work the way up into the core team. But then once they do join the core team, they get a lot of focus, attention, and mentoring and support and so on. And so one of the things I love the most is just to see their growth, see them take small risks and get big wins professionally and sometimes personally. So that really drives me. And then the other thing that I'll say is, and one of the things that I get really excited about twice a month now, is we have larger meetings, a little bit beyond the core team. And because we recruit from all over the world, we have like this sort of United Nations on the in the meeting. And of course, we, you know, everyone's in English, and that's part of a prerequisite. But just the multicultural mashup is fascinating for me. And then we're all united around the same campfire. We're all united around the same mission regarding modern slavery and combating modern slavery. So it's just wonderful to take part in that with this group of young, motivated professionals. I love it.
Well, I can only agree that that is part of the journey. And I mean, if you enjoy the journey and see these people grow and they become convicted to the company and make their biggest possible impact, that's always what you get energy from. I would have the same. You already made a nice bridge. You already sort of revealed the mission of the company. On your website, it says creating transparency to eliminate modern slavery.
Yeah.
Let's unpack that a little bit. The first question is, when you started the business in 2014, what was the problem that was screaming for a solution? And possibly that's already going towards the slavery part.
Yeah, the problem that was screaming for a solution in 2014. So in 2014, so, you know, 10 years or so ago, in the marketplace of supply chain, you know, analytics, supply chain research, supply chain, what have you, whatever that may be, understanding your supply chain, there was a lot of conversation in the market around how we could leverage big data to help, you know, understand, you know, a variety of questions that people were asking. The people that were asking were, you know, whether they were in compliance or regulatory or the general counsel or whatever they may be. They were all asking these questions about how do we apply big data to this problem? Because we're exposed in 85 jurisdictions worldwide or 85 countries worldwide, to not be so wonky. And we have 60,000 suppliers. So what do we do? And that was the sort of the ocean of the marketplace that Evidensity initially embarked into. And because we're, you know, small startup niche, the question that we were answering was, how do I obtain data on individuals and companies in the emerging market where that data is not available online or it's not available commercially? And so one of the first things that we did, Tone, was we looked at this concept of data taxonomy. So understanding how data is organized, right? And then put out into the market a very simple call and answer platform where our clients could log onto the platform, look at a menu, select country, and then select the item that they wanted, whether it's a corporate registry document or, you know, looking at a litigation court review or looking at a birth certificate or property record or whatever it may be. Ordering that like you would order sushi from a menu, right? And then we had people on the ground all over the world who would go stand in line, go queue in line, retrieve that document, and then scan it and upload it, and then it would be available to our client on the other end. So like a call and answer. But then along the way, we did that for, you know, that's all we did for like 3 years. And along the way, we built out a wonderful network of people. We mapped out data taxonomy in over 80 jurisdictions worldwide. And then we kept in all of that data. We kept it, we structured it, we organized it. And that's how we started. Yeah.
Yeah, I can understand the challenge that you have as a company when you are in 84 countries with 60,000 suppliers.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, the going back to the slavery part, it is all about, you know, aren't we buying from companies that aren't doing the right things, right?
That's right. That's right. So the solution providers that were offering these big data-driven solutions could help the global 2000. So think like the FTSE 100, or in the US, the S&P 500. On the Toronto Stock Exchange, there's maybe 80 companies that are very large multinational. In Latin America, they have this concept of multi-Latinas, right? So these Latin American-based multinational companies. And that's kind of the initial area that we were looking at. And these solutions providers said, great, well, we can give you a pane of glass solution. So you can log into one platform, have one dashboard, right? And see everything that's happening in all of these places. But the big problem that came out of that was there's all of these dark spots. There's all of these gaps in the data. There's all of these areas where, like, if I want to understand what's going on in the Eastern Congo, or I want to know what's going on in Eastern Turkey, or I want to know what's going on in Central Bolivia, if I want to just get a corporate registry document anywhere in Mexico, these were a lot of the gaps, and those are the holes that we were plugging initially,
Yeah.
right?
Initially, you did it sort of the non-scalable way with people.
Yeah, absolutely. Non-scalable with people.
Yeah, until you covered all the dots and the network became sort of green, green, green.
Right. And so as the holes were filled, and as we were building relationships with a lot of these providers, and you have to think of what's classically referred to as the Big Four. So your Ernst & Young, now known as EY, your PwC, your Deloitte, all of those folks, and there's others, those are just some that are better known. They all have these forensic services and these sort of business solutions. But then you also have these other larger companies coming out. One very well-known company in my space is called Exeger. And so we were in a position to support them and supply them with the data, the offline data that we were able to retrieve. And so for us, it was a natural evolution to go from, okay, we have a network of people on the ground. We know where and how and why we need to do what we need to do to stand in line and grab that offline data, that sort of analog. And so now let's move to the next iteration, which is very natural desktop research. And so then that's what we did. So we added desktop research to our service offering. And then the last thing that we did was we added a data scan. So now our users can, and our clients can come in, do a data scan as like a level one, is what we call it, or like a risk signal, because there's a risk signal component to it. And then the level two, which we call a risk screen, they can then come in and ask us to do the desktop research all within the same platform. And so that's where we also paused. This would have been going back to now the fall of 24. We rolled that out and then we improved it last fall and we continue to iterate on it. It's this sort of software as a service, free to go, pay as you join type of engagement. But then also has the API bit, the CSV file upload bit for higher volume and whatnot. And now we're in a really exciting phase of the business where we're finally able to get into the niche where we want to be, where we spend a lot of time, which leads to what you said, is sort of what you see when you land on our website. Right, the concept of transparency, which is huge, and I'd love to talk to you more about that. And then this concept of eliminating, not just combating, but eliminating modern slavery. And how do we
Exactly.
do that? You know?
Well, couple of questions on that one. First one is
Sure.
because I've seen you sort of grow and initially, of course, in a way that's really the hard way because you're just putting people on the ground to get to fill the dots and so on. It reminds me actually of a story that I have had with the CEO of a company called Sonetta in the very first year of my podcast. That was 2018. I actually covered him in my book, who also went that way in the shipper industry, whereby he went to the people that ship the containers, like the Coca-Colas, the Nikes, and so on, to ask them for the data on what does it cost to get from New York to Singapore, et cetera, all these, which was it. Yeah, he sort of with that he broke the monopoly of the shippers. And after about getting towards, I think, 2.5 million data points, which took a couple of years, and suddenly it took off, and the rest is history because it's now a data platform and a radically different business. So I see sort of a similar movement here. What did you do early on? What is an early decision that you took that appeared to be really important for your success that you have today?
So one of the early decisions that we made was to sort of, this would have been in the 2020 timeframe. So, the pandemic, kind of settles upon all of us like a wet blanket, and you're like sitting there wondering, okay, I'm no longer traveling anywhere. Like, no one's doing anything. So you have like, there's these introspective moments. And one of the things that I realized was the way that we had been capturing and sort of storing and managing our data was very much focused on the security portion of it, because we did manage some personal identifiable information, or what they call PII in the business. And we were compliant with all of that, but we had not yet taken the time from a technological sort of perspective to organize it in a way that was more scalable. And so taking that decision cost me a lot of money, cost us a lot of time. The opportunity cost as proceed was very high, because we were sort of, you know, heads down and focused sort of in the back office, kind of, you know, working on the business, not working in the business. So you can be under the hood and like working on the engine of your car, or you can be driving the car. Well, we weren't driving, we were under the hood, like figuring out how to reorganize it. And so that was a tough decision. I felt like it was risky. It was a tough decision. We had the cash, we had the people, but you think, okay, if I've got like 100,000 in the bank in cash, like what's the best way to put this capital to work? And you know, it's easy to hire people to sell. It's harder to hire people to like retool your entire data schema, right? And how all your data is organized. And it's very boring, and it's not a fun story to tell anyone. But that was a key decision for us, because now the platform that we're on now is infinitely scalable. The relational database that we've built on top of allows us to continue to add nodes and nodes and nodes and nodes and nodes. And it sets us up for what for us is the next level, which is where we're leveraging AI technology to sustainably build out, you know, these unique data sets that we build.
Yeah, I hear LLMs and that kind of stuff.
It was hard though.
Yeah, it's interesting how you kind of start a business without that technology available, still sort of sort it, and then suddenly your problem is solved in a way that it opens so many more opportunities.
Well if we Tone, if we hadn't have made the decision around the data schema that we made, we would today not be in the position that we're in to leverage the AI technology that's in the market, that frankly we need to leverage to keep up with the pace at which things are moving right now.
Let me make a small interruption here. Samuel just made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from conventional startup wisdom. The realization is not about immediate growth, but about building the right foundations for scalable, sustainable success. That change not only created technical advantages, but positioned the company to capitalize on future technology trends that competitors couldn't access. It's a trait remarkable software companies master. They focus on the essence by challenging everything that doesn't move the needle. Then, they master the art of curiosity, reading market signals earlier than competitors by understanding deeper patterns. And lastly, they acknowledge they cannot please everyone, leveraging micro-segmentation to find the customers truly aligned with their vision. And you can master these traits as well. The first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've dealt with those type of fundamental decisions quite a number of times in my career. And initially you sort of ignore it, or you try to ignore it, but at some point you have to bite the bullet and get two steps back in order to get three steps ahead or 10 steps ahead.
Right.
See the point. So, it's interesting because you sort of jump from 2014 to 2020. So you're already 6 years down the road.
Which
it proves again that, if you run a big idea, it doesn't have to be a success overnight.
No. I mean, whatever that phrase is that, you know, the overnight success took 10 years to get there. Yeah, that's so true.
It is so true.
There's no such thing as an overnight success.
So how did you actually make that decision? Was it like sort of a dead end road that you realized? Was it to prevent the negative, or was it to take the opportunity? What drove it more?
It was a conversation with a guy named Mike, who at the time was our VP of technology. And he said, Sam, the way the data is organized does not allow us to fully appreciate or to fully, leverage all of the information that we have. We're not able to build out additional suppliers or data suppliers that you keep telling me about, Sam, because I'm like, what about this one and this one and this one? So because my role is visionary, right? I am most naturally a chief visionary officer. You know, I like to tell our team, like, I am an acting CEO, right? Because I'm really the CVO. And so at some point, our COO will take the CEO job. I can't wait till that happens. I'm like working myself out of the CEO job, right? But at that time, I had all of this vision, all of these ideas, these different data suppliers, because we wanted to get in position for the modern slavery part. And I could see the path to get there. But the data schema that we had would not allow us to get there. So it was becoming a pain point for us. So it was like, to avoid a negative, we had to make this really tough decision to sort of take the car off the racetrack, put it in the shop, lift it up, and then just do all of this overhaul and then take it out for test drives and so on. So, yeah, so it was to prevent the negative, really, but then also seeing the opportunity.
Exactly. Yeah. Going back to the mission, you know, like eliminate modern slavery. Yeah. On the one hand side, I could almost say it is it's a huge problem in the market, almost a social problem. Have you seen hesitations when you go to a prospect or to an organization that you think can really benefit from your solution, that they don't see that, well, they don't, it doesn't resonate with them that you are solving a global, a huge problem, but you have to connect it back to the business problem they have.
You do. You do. Objections would be sort of the sales training term, right? Mm-hmm. And I deal with objections all the time, all the time. My background, this Evidencity is my fourth business. And so along the way, I've mostly learned from my mistakes how to get around these objections. But the other thing in this space is I can talk to a company like, you know, I can talk to a Starbucks that comes to mind, or I can talk to a large mining company, or, you know, T Connectivity is a classic S&P 500 company that no one's ever heard of, super exposed in the world. And I can talk to them and I can tell them about transparency and yada, yada, yada. But you very quickly can get a read on who's on the other side of the table when you begin to talk about just the word transparency alone. Because if you know, one were to look at how we've iterated over the years in our messaging, we've very quickly gotten into a place where we're looking beyond check the box compliance programs. We're getting beyond this whole idea of I'm going to do the minimum required to stay on the right side of the law. So that's, and to your point, that's probably 7 out of 10 prospects. It really is. Yeah. But then the three out of 10, when they see that value and they actually want to lift up the rocks and see what's underneath there, they want to pull back the curtain, that's a great engagement. And that gets the team fired up. But then also what we've done is we've gotten better at the way our data is organized and the way we allow the market to access our data. We can work with a Starbucks, but we can also work with the company that has already sold the platform to Starbucks. Because for that company, we just sell them our data, which is also fine, right? Yep. So for us, as there are more and more providers out there that are talking about supply chain X, Y, and Z that now has this sort of new vibe around combating modern slavery, there's a lot of people, and we're maybe 18 months ahead of the market, I think, but there's already some people, especially in Europe, and more specifically in the UK and in Northern Europe, talking about, okay, where's the data that's going to help us uncover these networks that are facilitating forced labor or that are facilitating sex trafficking that has this neat overlay with these massive supply chains? Well, we're in a really strong position to sell that data now, right?
Well, it reminds me of a picture that I saw at some point from the CEO of Vault Platform, which is one of the platforms whereby you can actually speak up in a company, which is a similar, well, it's maybe a similar type of problem, just on a company scale. And she literally had a picture of them being at a show, I think in Houston, Texas, whereby they literally said, okay, if you're here to check the compliance box, don't talk to us. Yeah. And I think that is the case, right? There are so many companies that are just in there, okay, we need to check the box, go get it. It's a cost of doing business, but these are possibly the wrong ones for you to start working with.
Correct. Correct. This is the qualifying. This is the qualifying stage. Yeah. And we can very quickly qualify people into the no column. And we just, we're polite. And if they want to come back later, you know, I had a conversation with a very large retail brand in the apparel industry. In a moment in Miami, I did a public speaking thing. And afterwards, I had someone come up to me, as one does when you speak from a stage. And he was very excited about what we're doing and blah, blah, blah. And he said, well, what exactly do you mean by transparency? And I gave him, you know, a couple of sentences, and I could see it in his face. And you know what his face told me, Tone? His face said, I'm in a culture where if I know about something, I have to do something about it.
Yeah.
And I survive in my world by not knowing about anything. So I'm a la, la, la kind of person.
Yeah.
And you're the opposite of that. You've helped me take my fingers out of my ears and help me face the music. Like, I'm the guy that ties Ulysses to the mast who can hear the sirens in a way, right?
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm talking a lot in my book, in my essays, in my dailies about this whole notion of getting on the same wavelength with people, which is exactly what happens around these type of topics. You stand for something. Mm-hmm. That is already one thing, you know. On your website, it is pretty clear what you stand for. And then you find the others that start thinking, hey, people like us do things like this, like Seth Godin always talks about. And when that magic happens and conversations become energetic and you start completing each other's sentences, you know it's a deal made in heaven.
Yeah, and those point, are great moments. Those
exactly,
are great moments.
And to your point also, where that is not happening, then in 10 minutes time, you can get to a no fast, which is also good, you know? I mean, don't pull a dead horse.
Yeah, exactly. Fast no's are great for everybody. It's the worst is the slow no, you know?
Exactly.
And if it's going to be a yes, it's rarely like an immediate fast yes. But, you know, they say that you need 7 yeses to close a deal. So the first couple yeses come very fast. And then you get a couple more, and then you get a couple more. Yeah. And by the time you're at that 5th, 6th, 7th yes, you're really just around like formulating the engagement and sort of trying to figure out where and how you begin. And, you know, as they say, you don't eat an elephant all at once. You kind of take it bit by bit. So a lot of times you like to say, well, what's your pain point? Like, what is the jurisdiction or the jurisdictions where you're feeling most exposed? And, you know, very quickly we can, if we're talking to the right person, like director of transparency, that title actually exists in some companies. And that for me is a great sign. But this person, I just spoke with someone today, director of transparency is his title. He's like, okay, well, Vietnam, India, and South Korea, those are my pain points. Fantastic. So we start there, you know?
Yeah, exactly. They need to care first. It's all about psychographics rather than, because these companies on the outside look exactly the same size-wise, country distribution size and so on. But it's the people and the whole mindset internally that matters so much more. Yeah. So what did you learn from getting to your first 10 or 100 customers? What were the most...
What did I learn? Yeah, that's a great question. What did I learn? I'll tell you one thing I learned. Sales is not my strength. You know? And I had another call today about it. We're looking for someone to help us continue to build out the team on the East Coast in the U.S., I'm decent at it. I'm good enough at it. Like, you know, they say if you're a founder of a business, your job is to set the vision, raise the capital, build the first sort of solid team. And so we've done that. And now we're kind of in that scale up stage as a business, sort of, we're like teenagers. So, you know, I've said, okay, I need my ops team, sort of the core. I need my tech team. We have an entire research team. And then now we're building the sales team. So, you know, one of the things I learned is like, I'm not the salesperson that Evidencity needs at this stage in its growth. That's one thing I've learned. The second thing I learned is the language and the angling that we want for us as a brand and as a business in the marketplace, so that we can have the broadest possible avenue to either engaging with a company directly to actually solve their modern slavery issue, which is like for us where we love to be. And that's one end of the spectrum. But then also realizing that there are many, 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 many companies out there that would also buy our data, right? Mm-hmm. And so as you get into like 15, 16, 17, 20, 30 sales engagements, whether they're one-offs or you get into a data licensing agreement, you begin to learn a little bit more about what you can actually do as a business. And if you look at our landing page now, you see that we have, you know, we have a signal, We have a screen, we have a solvent, we have a monitor. So as you get deeper into these relationships, you also have folks who come back to you and say, well, you guys did this like really well. Could you maybe monitor for me? Yep. You're like, huh. You know, so along the way, you also learn where your solution set can begin to stretch in a way that's organic and natural. And that's how you grow as a business sort of horizontally, right?
Yep.
You're sort of growing out your wings so you can fly higher and further with less fuel.
I like that analogy. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now that's how it happens. And it's just, yeah, it's listening to learn from customers.
Mm. Absolutely.
And then have the curiosity to explore what they really mean about it. And then, yeah, then make the decision to go after it or not. Are you already at a stage where like growth is predictable? Because you're talking about, okay, we're scaling right now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found that motion yet?
Yeah, we're in a space now where the, you know, where years ago when we're, because accounting is looking behind, financials is looking forward. So when you're looking at your financials and you're thinking, okay, we've got a board meeting coming up and I want to be able to sit down with the board and say, okay, guys, like, and gals, this is what we're looking at. This is what we're going for. There's a certain kind of feeling you get in your gut where, you know, you're expecting someone to ask the question, well, you know, is this your realistic? Is this your pessimistic? Is this your optimistic? And so as those financials mature, as you mature as a business, you're really less about doing the optimistic and the pessimistic because the realistic is much more real. And because of the contracts you have and the relationships you have and the posture in the market, you can begin to stretch it out further. Why? Because you have a pipeline that you're looking at. And we also have learned how to do confidence weighting. And so as we get more mature as a business, leaning into that confidence weighting allows me to stretch my pipeline further into the future. And at this point, we're building ARR to get a nice valuation for our Series B. That's kind of the space we're in as a VC-backed firm. You know, from your Series A, which is like, I think I've got product market fit, but it's a little bit loose still, but I've got a couple customers, I'm cash flow positive. Like that's your Series A moment.
Yeah.
Your Series B moment is like, here's the machine, pour fuel in, off we go, right?
Yeah.
And so getting to the space where I can confidently sit down and raise that level of cash at the valuation that I feel like I can strongly protect with my narrative, my financial narrative, that's kind of the space we're in now. Yeah. And
great.
And the confidence weighting is key because everyone resonates with that.
Well, I mean, talking about this person here, I just finished an essay about this problem of unpredictable pipeline. Hmm. And there's a number of those cases. We didn't call it confidence weighting, but I think it's adding up to that. So what is your formula for confidence weighting?
Okay, so in my pipeline, I won't name the name of the company, but I'll give an example. There's a company in Prague. They have 6,800 and something suppliers between Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They would like for us to actually do a screen of the entire bulk of it. And then if we find anything, they're open to the discussion about how are you going to solve it for us? Like, what is actually the solution? And so let's say we apply a price of $200,000 for that one-off engagement. And so at 100% confidence, you put in your pipeline $200,000. And then as you get out of the meeting or you get another micro yes or some sort of maybe there's a market setback or the winds, you get a little headwinds or something, you may drop that down from 100 because we're never truly at 100 until you actually sign the contract. So, you know, we may drop it down from 100 to 80 or down to 75. And so that's kind of that confidence, and it's highly subjective. But what we do is we double dip because I'm more of a, you know, optimistic visionary. My COO is more of a realistic integrator. So he sees the details and he's like, I don't know if we can be that optimistic about this deal. So I'll do my confidence weighting. So we'll go from like, you know, 100% to 80%. So now you're taking 80% of 200,000 and that's the value of the deal now. But then Mike, my COO, will come in and be like, yeah, I'm not feeling that good about this deal. So I'm going to bring our 80% down to 65. And then now you're at 65% of the 200,000. And then that's the number that's in our pipeline. And that's usually the starting point. And then as we get these micro yeses, we'll bump up 5% or 10%, depending on, you know, the yes.
Yeah. Do you have specific questions or specific answers that need to be provided?
Well, so we run two different types of discoveries. So one discovery is to understand what information they have on board for their supplier. So what is our starting point in terms of the data that you have in-house? If you've got nothing, then that for us lowers our confidence. Why? Because now we've got a blank slate, which in some cases is great, but we'd much rather work off of a more robust compliance program that because our value add is not building your compliance program. We don't do that. So if you don't have one, then you're going to be probably disorganized. There's going to be a lot of gaps in your data. If you think of it as like a big spreadsheet, a lot of cells are going to be blank, right? And so there's a discovery there. And then there's what we call a technical discovery. So what is their tech stack? How are they managing the data? How are they ingesting our data? When we take their entire spreadsheet, say their spreadsheet has, 6,000 rows and six columns, and each column is like first name, last name, ID number, email address, whatever it may be. We want to return that same spreadsheet to them, but with eight columns or 10 columns. Ideally, for us, we keep it all in a virtual private server, secure FTP back and forth, and it goes out and it comes back into whatever system they have. But Tone, if they don't have that system, if they're not technologically savvy where they don't know what a secure FTP is, if they can't manage that, then that's really going to weigh down our confidence. Why? Because, and this has happened to us. This happened to us. We had a big engagement in Central America 4 years ago, and we were churning through. They had over a million different rows of data to go through, and we were churning through it at 3, 4, 5,000 a day. And they got to a point where they ended up unilaterally canceling the contract because we were processing so much data for them. They couldn't handle it. They couldn't ingest it. They couldn't bring it back. And so it was like, oh, we should have known about that before we engaged with them, right?
Exactly.
And so that was a tough kind of situation to manage for maybe about 60 days at the very end of that engagement. And so we have these two discovery. And so I lead the first discovery, and we have, 15, 20 questions in that space. But that's like you start with a list of 15, it ends up being 30 questions because you iterate. And then Mike, our COO, who used to be our VP of technology, leads the technical discovery. And he usually brings in one of our senior dev guys. And if they want to let us have a peek at their stack and kind of how they manage their data, that for us is actually a huge micro yes, as I mentioned before, seven yeses. That's a really big one. And that raises confidence. So you create these moments that allow for micro yeses to happen almost like serendipitously. But then you also create moments where you can sort of turn up and turn down the dial in confidence. So you can strengthen or weaken the hypothesis on whether or not you're going to close the deal or whether or not you want to work with them to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah, true. There's so many components to it, and it's not even if they have already decided you're going to be the one, because there's so many things that can derail it. Yeah, exactly. I like that. I like the story. Let's compare notes on that at some point. Looking at the time as well. Yeah, if you would, because we're now 11 years down the road, if you would start a company from scratch again, what would you do differently then?
What would I do differently? I would let's see. There's starting the company from scratch, which is one point of origin. There's another point of origin, though, and I can speak to both, of sort of rebooting the company once you've raised your Series A, right? Because I bootstrapped Evidencity on the back of the P&L from my other business. And so my other business incubated Evidencity for 8 or 9 months. And so one of the things that I would do differently is I would have hired someone external to run the day-to-day for me at Evidencity so that I could keep an eye on the ball of my other business that actually suffered quite a bit from my absence,
Yeah,
right?
true.
It's typical founder's dilemma, right? You can't be too far from the baby without the baby going haywire. Right. And I learned a lot about the founder's dilemma that way. But from that original point of origin, that's something I would have done differently. And the self-awareness tone about knowing that I'm not an integrator, I'm a visionary. Right. And so having that self-awareness and then knowing that I need to hire someone to cover my flank in that integrator weakness space would have been a massive game changer for me. I'd probably be at 10 years ahead of where I am now in terms of our ARR and whatever impact in the world that we want to have. But then post Series A, the one thing that I would have done is I would have taken longer, I would have spent more time because one of the wonderful things that raising capital allows you to do is the exact opposite of what most young founders want to do. Most young founders, when they suddenly find themselves with $1 million liquid in the bank, for a lot of us, that's the first time we've ever seen that many zeros in our bank account. It's really exciting. What's the first thing you want to do? Because it's all emotional. You want to go spend the money. You want to start hiring people and developing this and doing that and blah, blah, blah. I would have done the opposite. I would have waited. I would have spent a ton of time on deep customer interviews. I would have done a way more market research. I wouldn't have hired anyone. And the first person I would have hired would not have been a salesperson, because that's what I did. And that was a huge mistake. She lasted 6 months because she mostly just sat around twiddling her thumbs. I was like, that was a mistake. I would have hired a tech person. And today, if I were doing that today in 2025, I would hire a machine learning AI person and a data scientist. Those would be my first two hires.
All for leverage, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, you have the responsibility to get that million to 10 million and beyond.
Exactly. And data is the new oil. So, you know, you got to understand how to manage it. You got to understand how to generate value with data. If you can't do that, then you shouldn't be in business today. I don't care what you do.
No, true. Yeah. Exactly. Fascinating. So in that whole journey, was there anything, what has been a counterintuitive lesson that you learned scaling the business?
Counterintuitive lesson that I learned. I would have to go back to the speed. You know, one of the things that I've learned from living in Spain is to appreciate the slower pace here, to appreciate how Spaniards move through the day. Because, you know, I'm from the United States and we move through the day much differently than they do in Spain. The whole concept of a siesta is very foreign to an American mindset, right? Or more generally speaking, to even a Western mindset. And so what's counterintuitive, what's intuitive is I need to run harder and faster and stay ahead of the market. What's counterintuitive is a lot of times what you think you see in the market is a mirage, right? You think you see something, you see like a little kernel of what's actually true, but then your brain creates something that's not there, right? And so you're looking at a mirage and thinking, I've got to run hard so I can get to there. I get there before someone else does. What's counterintuitive is spending more time with culture. What's counterintuitive is spending more time with one-on-one with my direct reports, getting to know them. What's counterintuitive for a leader is to be vulnerable first. I wish I'd done that more often when I was younger. And the other thing that's super counterintuitive that for me has served me so, so well is all of my direct reports and their direct reports, they all read my user manual. So years ago, I wrote a Sam Logan user manual, which helps them understand how I like to communicate, how I like to manage my time, and how I like people to communicate to me. And all of my people who work with me directly, they all have user manuals. And that's counterintuitive because what it does is it creates this layer of vulnerability and openness that otherwise a lot of people sort of kind of hide behind the screen. They hide behind their keyboard, especially nowadays, like everyone's remote, everyone telecommutes. But that user manual really brings me closer to whoever I'm working with. And I know that they've got quirks and whatever because it's in their user manual. So all of those things being counterintuitive in my mind, I would do all of them. You know, vulnerability, forward to the people, user manual, don't go so fast, you know?
And it's so true. So, I mean, how has that, in relation to all of that, how has your definition of success changed over the last 10 years?
Time. More time with my family, more freedom of time. I'll tell you what, I've been working really hard for 2.5 decades across business endeavors and whatnot. But last summer, for me to commit to an entire summer to spend it with my son living in a van, and to have everything sort of from a process standpoint and from a direct report management standpoint established so I could have more freedom of time, that for me is how I would define success.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's not about you controlling the business. It's actually, have you organized this so well that the moment you leave,
it just keeps running.
Keep going. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Not to say that I haven't walked away and watched the whole thing fall over and be like, oh my God, I thought it was going to sit up on its own. You got to run back and deal with it. Uh-huh. You know, that's happened plenty. But last summer, you know, there were a couple moments when I was scrambling, like don't hear what I'm not saying, but there were extended moments like weeks when I had three stand-ups, boom, 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 all on Monday, and then the rest of my week. You've got this, like you can get me if you need me. But
That's right.
otherwise, like
Exactly.
do what you know. I trust you. I trust your judgment.
That's the whole fundamental, formula for a successful company. The autonomy you give people, like you say, the diversity in the faces, the United Nations group together, where everybody contributes to, well, to the mission. Going back to the beginning of the call. I mean, let's pause it here. Like maybe one more advice. What would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other tech entrepreneurs based on
Other
what you've
tech
learned so far?
entrepreneurs. Do find, and I've actually got a dinner with my group this evening, but do find someone who you can be completely open kimono with, completely transparent with, because especially in technology, like we spend so much time thinking about, okay, my IP, my moat, how am I going to protect the business? How am I going to prevent others from, with $10 million or much bigger company than me, how am I going to prevent them from doing what I've done and just, taking my market share? There's a lot of fear there. And so there's this mindset of scarcity that we can very quickly get into in terms of like, who can I sell what I'm building to stay in that mindset of abundance. So do stay in a mindset of abundance, but the best way to do that is to surround yourself with people. If it's just one person, better than none, but ideally three or four, where everyone is going around and taking turns talking about what they're dealing with. People call it mastermind, whatever you want to call it, it's fine. But do find a group of people that you trust who you can bring all of their problems to. And conversely, don't run alone. Full stop. And a lot of us think we can run alone. And that's the fastest way to burn out, is to try and run alone.
Exactly. Well said. And I mean, I completely agree with your point about the mastermind because I see this happening every single week. It's
All the time.
yeah,
I'm going
exactly.
to mine tonight. We're having getting together for dinner. So
Oh,
yeah.
you actually got a local one.
I'm gonna go home. I'm gonna change because that's it. They have to dress smart, and then off I go.
Good. Well. Let's do that then. Thanks for sharing the wisdom and being open about like what you learned and the vulnerability that you put across in everything you said. Where can people go to find out more about you or Evidensity?
The easiest spot, evidencity.com. We also have a page on LinkedIn, and then also me. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I have a Substack. I publish stuff there. So that's probably the best place to start. And it's pretty easy to find me from there. Like, I'm right here. I'm pretty accessible. So people want to have a chat, we'll make it happen.
Yeah, perfect. Well, good luck on the next part of the journey.
Thank you.
We'll do another podcast in 2, 3 years' time to see
Come on.
where you are right then.
Bingo, as they say.
Exactly. Gracias.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate the time. It was fun.
And this ends my conversation with Samuel, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspires you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Samuel Logan, founder and CEO of Evidensity. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.